I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Kurt Petrovich joins me now. He has just published a remarkable book, Blamed and Broken, The Mounties and the Death of Robert Jakansky. It is a riveting, necessary book. In October 2007, Jakansky arrived at Vancouver International Airport hoping to start a new life from his native Poland. He languishes in the airport for several hours by the baggage claim, separated by glass from where the public waits. Jakansky doesn't go out because he's expecting his mother, while she can't go into that part of the airport. After several hours, he is acting erratically, smashing things inside the terminal, unable to express in English what he wants or needs. Soon the RCMP are called in, and he is tasered. Another passenger at the airport pulls out a video camera and tapes the situation, and soon the video becomes ubiquitous, and soon conclusions are drawn as to who's at fault and worse. In this riveting book, Mr. Petrovich goes beyond the outrage at home and abroad over the use of force, about the so narratives about Jakansky, the four officers involved, to how more than one person died in 2007, how the lives of so many have been upended, and how regulation and procedures might have changed in the over 11 years since. And Kurt, through his reporting and now the writing of this book, looks at the millions of dollars spent on an inquiry and imperfect prosecutions. Kurt Petrovich is an investigative journalist with over three decades of experience reporting on national and international stories for the CBC. He has followed the Robert Jakansky matter since that fateful night, the 14th of October 2007. His Twitter handle is at RetroCanada, and the website for more is at KurtPetrovich.ca. The book is published by Dundurn. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Kurt Petrovich. Mr. Petrovich, good morning.
Good morning, Joseph.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So as I was telling you before we started, it's a wonderfully written book. This is your first book.
Mm-hmm.
Did you want to write, say, growing up?
For the last 30-odd years, I've always loved being a journalist. It wasn't something that I came to at a young age. I think at a young age I wanted to be an astronaut, which is perhaps there are some parallels with journalism. I don't know. But, I've been a journalist since I was in my early 20s, and I had never thought about writing a book. I've done years and years of radio, television, online, and that was good for me. The idea of writing a book seemed like way too much work for too little effort, too little audience, and... I think really I was afraid of writing a book because it really is a difficult undertaking. It's not like even an hour-long documentary. And so I had never thought about writing a book until I got to a point in this story where I started to see certain things happening. And because of the length of time that I had already invested as just an observer, as a journalist, but just as an observer, I started to see patterns. I started to see things. I started to learn things that would only make sense if they were laid out on a canvas the size of a book, if you could take a step back from them and see all the puzzle pieces, not as individual pieces or individual stories, but as a giant jigsaw puzzle where everything fit together, or as a tapestry where all the threads come together and you suddenly see the image of something. And I knew that pretty much the only way to tell that story would be in literary form, and that's what I set out to do a few years ago.
I'll ask you later in the interview whether you've solved the matter or you have a better picture of it now than, say, when you started the book, but... the thing that impressed me about the book, not that you wrote the book to impress me, but well, you've obviously followed this case through your reporting, and it's easy for a reporter to say just write down everything that happened. But this book goes beyond that because you do an incredible amount of research in terms of what happened, and when you talk to the people, because you literally have talked to everybody.
Involved. I've tried.
Yeah. Are there who are the ones that say didn't want to talk to you?
Well, they're not mentioned in the book. but there are people who did want to talk to me who didn't want to be known for talking to me.
Sure.
They're also in the book.
Right.
You just don't necessarily – it's not overt. But there, as I think I say in the in the preface to the book, there are a lot of people that I spoke to whose contributions are there. You just don't necessarily realize it.
It's a very full picture of what happened, and especially it gives us the color of these people's lives and the terrible things that have happened since. When was it for you, because you mentioned this a moment ago, that you started thinking that this wasn't adding up, if you will?
I've had obviously a lot of time to think about this. I was there on day one, the morning that Robert Jakansky died. Very early in the morning, he was declared dead around 2 a.m. on a Sunday morning in October of 2007. And that morning I was called into work to basically do my job of reporting on what happened as best as we could. Lots of people were called into work that day because it wasn't a usual occurrence that somebody died at Vancouver's International Airport after having an altercation with the RCMP and a taser being used. So there were lots of elements there. But I think by and large, I think most people just sort of assume that it was one of those stories that would just kind of resolve itself and we'd move on to the next story. But as I lay out in the book, a whole series of things happened that made this not just another police-involved death. The fact that somebody recorded the whole incident or as much of it as anybody had, and that the RCMP had that, and there were some mistakes made initially in how the RCMP described what had happened. Mm-hmm. And then this is also, you have to understand, this occurred in 2007 against a backdrop in which the RCMP was already facing an enormous amount of public scrutiny and I dare I say, scorn for a number of very high-profile in-custody deaths.
Ian Bush case
was still in everyone's mind. There were a number of others. And something sort of happened. I think a number of my colleagues in the media immediately assumed that there was much more to this story than we were being told, in the sense that it was almost a conspiracy to try to prevent the public from really understanding what happened. And that was kind of the narrative that was created at the time, that, you know, the RCMP was trying to cover it up. Who were these four? What did they do? Why did they do what they did? And that really sort of carried through in the months of coverage that ultimately led up to a public inquiry that was called. And, even during the public inquiry, I think amongst many of my colleagues, there was a kind of foregone conclusion coming from this narrative that these four police officers who were involved in Robert Jakansky's death were ultimately trying to cover up what they did. Now they were trying to lie about covering things up. And lo and behold, when Thomas Braidwood, the retired appeal court judge, rendered his report into all of this, that's essentially what he determined, that these four RCMP officers were unbelievable. They were dishonest, self-serving, lousy police officers. That's where the narrative essentially got cast into stone. And from that, it turned into criminal prosecutions for lying at the public inquiry for these four officers. And throughout all of this, I was unsatisfied. I mean, I did my job to report what I heard and what the evidence was. That being the case, I mean, even when the inquiry was going on, the inquiry started hearing evidence 10 years ago this month into this matter. And I was troubled by what I heard and saw people saying online about what was going on. People were misrepresenting the evidence. They were inventing things that didn't happen. And I went to my bosses at the time and I said, look, we're not doing anybody any public service by allowing these kinds of rumors and conspiracy theories and just flat out factually false bits of information being disseminated, especially on our websites where people are making comments right. after stories. So I said, let me invite people to ask questions. I'm at the inquiry every single day. I'll do my best to answer those questions for people. And we'll at least, I'll feel satisfied that I'm at least doing what I'm there to do as a journalist, which is to try to, you know, disseminate the best obtainable version of the truth. And so you can actually go online and still see this 300 some odd questions that I answered 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And the kinds of questions people asked and the answers that I gave. That being said, it still wasn't, I still felt like we were missing the story. And to me, as a journalist, one of the aspects that we were missing were these four officers themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, we heard them at the inquiry, but they gave, you know, short you know, very guarded answers to things. And this, as much as an inquiry is not supposed to be about finding blame, it was fairly adversarial. I mean, these four officers walked into this inquiry, and it was clear, I think, from the questions they were asked. I mean, the result is there in Braidwood's inquiry report. You can read it. But the questions that were asked, the kinds of assumptions that were made, a number of lawyers, and that's their job. Their job was to put it to these officers that they did X, Y, and Z to try to find inconsistencies, to try to get at the truth. It was clear that these four officers were under the gun and that there was absolutely no way they were going to walk out of this inquiry blameless. And as a result, I think their answers and what they said left me really wanting, because I didn't feel like I knew yeah. anything after they had testified. So I knew, number one, I needed to talk to those four officers and not just, what did you see, what did you do? I needed to find out more about what had actually gone on.
So if there are these sort of narratives that have already been cast in stone, even before the inquiry, after the inquiry, and the vilification of these four officers. I mean, I guess as I'm reading the book, I want to know who's to blame for all of this. And in that aspect of how these four officers were, say, are perceived even today, who's to blame for that? I mean, you're a journalist. Does the media shoulder some blame, say?
Well, absolutely. I mean, and I include myself in that. I mean, I want to be clear. I didn't write or report anything that was factually wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And if I did, if somebody wants to show it to me, I'll have a look at it and take responsibility for it. But I don't think I did. In fact, you know, during this process, I was proud that people with the inquiry, as well as the lawyers representing the officers, both said that I had done a good job of being even-handed and fair. So mm-hmm. I'm not worried about that. That being said, I was still part of a collective that was pumping out information about this event. And at the time, I was trying to be exceedingly cautious about saying one thing or another. I just wanted to report what I heard, and that was enough. The problem over time that I came to understand that if you just simply report what you hear, sometimes that's not journalism. That's stenography.
Mm-hmm.
That's just telling people what was said on both sides.
Right.
And, you know, there's this notion somehow that, you know, that's what journalism is supposed to be. You're supposed to report both sides. But that's, you know, I hate to break it to you, but that's really not what journalism is or should be. because there is no, it's a false equivalency in many, many cases to say that both sides are equal or all sides are equal. There simply is not. I mean, there are certain things that we accept as true. And sometimes you have to come out and say that something is true, even though there's another side that says it's not. They don't get equal weight. And that becomes even more complicated when you have a series of official processes, like a public inquiry, like a criminal trial, and the things you're hearing are coming from official sources, from authoritative sources, that takes on a huge amount of weight. But it's our jobs as journalists, it's my job as a journalist, I think, to certainly absorb and understand what I'm being told, but to never stop questioning, to never stop holding something up to the light and say, well, does that make sense? Is that true? And, you know, certainly if we're talking about the criminal courts, any journalist who goes into a criminal court in British Columbia or anywhere else for that matter in this country, it's an intimidating environment. There are people talking about things that you may or may not understand. There are all kinds of procedures and protocols. I mean, even just for sitting there and paying attention, there are certain rules. Then there's rules about what you can report and what you can't, and you know, whether you can talk to certain people or not talk to certain people. And at the end of the day, it becomes very easy just to take what the lawyers say and what the judge says in open court and report that as fact, which it is. It's fact. But in many cases, or at least in some cases, you know, if you're a journalist and you're covering a trial for something, such as the trial of these four officers who were charged with perjury, if you don't sit there every day in court during their trials to understand what the evidence is, what the arguments are about why they're guilty or not guilty, what the strategies are that the Crown is employing, what the strategies are that the defense lawyers are employing, what are the questions the judge is asking? What are the signals that the judge may be giving about whether he or she believes this evidence? If you're not there to sort of take it all in and get an understanding of what's really going on, simply showing up at the end of it when the judge releases his or her decision and just simply reporting that, that isn't really doing anybody a service. All you're simply doing is becoming a stenographer. And I know many of my colleagues will be infuriated and offended that I say something like that, in part because it's simply not practical to expect that a journalist is going to be allowed by their employer to sit through every single day of a trial. It's just economically not possible. That being said, in this case, for me, in order to understand what was really going on here, I had to do it. And I was fortunate in that I had the ability to do it. And I could not have written this book if I had not been a personal witness to so much that many people just have not seen or heard. I mean, during the trials for these four officers that stretched on, I mean, they started in 2013 and they went all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada in the end of 2017. I sat through virtually every single minute of each of those trials, and I even went to Ottawa to sit in on the hearing, which was extremely informative for me. You know, if I had not been able to do that, I wouldn't have been able to write this book. And you know, there were many, many, many days where I sat in court, and I was the only person in there, other than the lawyers and the accused and the judge and, you know, the court reporter. The gallery was empty, you know, and I just, I got to tell you, I was perplexed because to me, this was supposed to have been this enormous, offensive use of force by the RCMP. A man died. We held a public inquiry. The public inquiry condemned these four officers as liars, the worst kind of police officers. And then it came to actually holding them to account in a criminal trial, and nobody shows up. There's something just wrong with that. You know, I understand what the financial constraints are in the, you know, the modern media world. But again, the people who weren't there missed the story.
Well, let's talk about journalism for just a sec, because that's something that that I find interesting in what you've just said. I guess we're living in an era, the Trump era, where a lot of people are turning to journalists for information, for news and the sort. Do you think there's a revival in that sense in your business, and do you think the media will change as such?
You know, there's I have a lot of colleagues who are I look up to as role models about how to focus in on a story and really concentrate on it. And you know, I don't mind saying that a number of those role models are people connected with the national public broadcaster, CBC, because that kind of journalism is, I think, still appreciated and encouraged where possible. You know, one of the things I wrestled with as I sort of contemplated writing a book based on what I was seeing and hearing and what I was understanding and learning was that there were going to be a lot of people who didn't like it because it contradicts that narrative that I spoke of about, you know, that easy narrative of, you know, four cops go in and they basically murdered a man, which is how some people still believe this is boils down to, which is simply not the case. And all you have to do is read the book to understand why that's false. But I mean, I could have simply reported on things and walked away from it, as most of us do as journalists. And I think some of the criticism of journalism that comes in the form of, well, that's fake news, or, you know, that's not true, or you're biased, or you're presenting a particular point of view. Don't give me your point of view. I just want the facts. Well, as I explained, journalism isn't just about reporting facts. That's stenography. The facts are important, and they have to be accurate, and they have to be right. That's the first tier of actually being a journalist. The second tier, which is actually where the skill and the profession comes in, is actually being able to tell people and connect the dots. What do those facts mean? And I think there's less of that. And it's hard to do. It's very difficult to do, especially in a case like Blamed and Broken, because you have a number of official sources saying, look, we know what the story is. The story is X. And if you start to question that, that starts to become a liability for you as a journalist. I mean, I know there are people who probably won't talk to me anymore because they've read what's in the book and don't like it. That's okay. I think as a journalist, you have to have a bit of a thick skin. I think as a journalist, you also have to understand that in some ways, I mean, this isn't the be-all, end-all, but in some ways, if you're not causing people to be a little uncomfortable, I think you have to question why you're working on a particular story. I mean, we all need survival information. You know, there was a crash here, or it's going to rain tomorrow, or here's what the price of a loaf of bread is. We all need that. But I think what's more important than ever is the notion, especially in this era where we all carry around these phones and we're glued to them and everything is in 140 characters and we only care about what happened in the last 30 seconds. And everybody has the same equal weight of a voice in a forum like Twitter where, you know, if you have a certain number of followers or even if you don't have any followers, if you say something that takes on some kind of weight. I mean, to a certain extent, you know, I think we need more than ever journalists who don't abandon a story until every question is asked and every potential answer is received. And we follow the ball and we don't get misled and we don't accept the official story for necessarily the truth because they're not always the same thing.
So then your employer, the CBC, you have people like yourself. There are other people like you who are able to devote the time that they need to on a story like this, right?
Well, I should be absolutely crystal clear. This book, Blamed and Broken, is not the product of my work with CBC. I mean, I was obviously present in the room as a reporter when some of these things occurred, especially years ago. But I've actually been on leave for a number of years now. And I wrote this, and the material in this book is not a... It's not a rehash of the stories that I wrote. It's not a...
You've done your own research in terms of... Yeah.
It's stuff that I think... I think even the CBC would have had trouble greenlighting because it's the kind of thing that takes an incredible amount of time and energy, and I say that not to in any way, shape, or form criticize the CBC, but the CBC is not in the business of writing books.
Sure.
So recognizing that, I took advantage of the fact that I was not working. And this thing was itching at me that, you know, this was a story that needed to be told. And so where and when I could, I did the work on it on my own.
Let's go back to something you said a moment ago about facts. And, you know, when you hear of a situation like this, you want to know everything. And so you think, well, you find out that there's a video. Well, let's watch this. And that's it. You know, that's what happened. We can see it for ourselves. But, I mean... I was just thinking, too, that it was 2007. The video went viral without really... The internet did it.
I mean, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, if that happened today, it would have been 100 times seen. You know?
It was... I mean, that video shot by Paul Pritchard, who was a bystander in the Vancouver International Airport, did go viral. It was probably one of the first videos of police use of force to sort of... sweep across social media globally. I mean, we're kind of used to it now. I mean, you open up your Facebook feed and you can almost count on seeing something from the United States, some police officer beating somebody up or whatever. We've kind of become immune to it almost. But back in 2007, this was terribly shocking. It wasn't just shocking to see that video. Most people who saw it, I mean, two things went on with that video. By the time it became available for public consumption, you knew how it ended. Before you even saw the first frame of that video, you knew that at the end, a man died. So that's really critical. Secondly, most people who watch that video had never up until that point ever seen police use force in any situation, except maybe on a cop show on television, which is not how it actually happens.
Right.
So those two things combined when that video came out, and you have to also acknowledge that there was this tug of war between the RCMP and Paul Pritchard, who shot the video, over when it could be released, how he would get it back. And so, as well, just prior to the release of the video, there was this aura that the police don't want you to see this. They're afraid of it. They're trying to cover it up. I mean, it's actually not true. They knew the video was going to be made public. It was not something that was going to vanish. But that as well. So people sit down and they watch this video with all of that going on, and they're, rightly so, horrified. It's horrible to watch what happened. That being said, what developed almost instantly in the public consciousness was somebody's got to pay for this. Somebody's got to pay. And I think we all know who the people were that were going to pay. It was those four officers in the video. And so what I do in Blamed and Broken is I actually break the video down into components that most people don't see, that even the inquiry either overlooked or downplayed, again, because it didn't quite fit this narrative that four police officers were involved in a man's death. I mean, one of the things that just to this day, I mean, you ask people who have sort of, maybe a passing familiarity with the video and Robert Jakansky and that man who was tasered at YBR, they talk about those police officers that just brutalized him. Well, you know, if you watch the video, the moment these police officers arrive, they are cordial. They are not in a rush. The first officer who greets Robert Jakansky says, "How's it going, bud? How you doing?" They try to talk to him. It's clear that there's a language barrier. They are thinking they're going to arrest him because of all the reports that have come in of him damaging property. They can see stuff that's smashed on the floor. They've got people in the waiting area saying, "That's the man." Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've had these 911 calls. And so they have all been trained to use this weapon, this tool, they call it, on their belt, called a taser, because it's supposed to be less harmful than actually wrestling with somebody or trying to strong arm them. So they're not going to use the taser until the moment that Robert Jakansky turns around. He's suddenly got this object in his hand. He's holding it defensively. It's a stapler. Mm-hmm. And it's not a stapler like he's going to staple some sheets of paper together. He's actually grabbed it in a way to open it up in his fist as if he's going to swing at or throw it or punch or whatever it is. In that instant, there's a decision to use the taser. This weapon, they've been told, will immediately knock him down to the floor, render him completely incapacitated, and after some very painful sensation, they'll be able to put the cuffs on him. It doesn't happen that way. And these police officers who've just been trained on this weapon are kind of stunned. Literally, they're like, "Wait a minute, this isn't working." Like, he's supposed to go down and be completely compliant. Mm-hmm. He's fighting us. Like, what's going on? So, you know, these are things that get lost in that video, because unless you know what these police are thinking and why they're doing what they're doing, it appears the way most people were primed to see the video before they saw it, which was four police officers go in and kill a man.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's, I guess, one version. You can look at the video and say, yeah, that's what happened. But that's not the truth of it. That's not the best obtainable truth of what happened. And unfortunately, unless you actually sit down and analyze not just the video, but everybody else in that room, including the four officers themselves, and then you hold up all those pieces like a jigsaw puzzle and put them together, you start to realize, as I did, that the narrative that we were essentially told is not true. It's just not.
Did you wonder how different this would have all turned out had there not been a video?
I have no doubt whatsoever. Had there not been a video, nothing would have come of this. Almost nothing. There certainly wouldn't have been an inquiry. So on the one hand, it's a good thing that there was an inquiry, because one of the things to come out of the inquiry, there was a first part of the inquiry, which was called a study commission into the use of the taser, and that revealed all kinds of details about how the RCMP approved this weapon, how potentially dangerous it is, how it is really not as non-lethal or as less harmful than physically grappling with somebody in some cases. As a result of this, and as a result of the inquiry, the public inquiry, the RCMP definitely changed its training methods, changed its approach to the use of the taser, and we can have an argument about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing if police are now, or have been since, more reluctant to use a taser and resort to a firearm instead. I mean, that's a debate you can have. But so I don't want to, as much as I'm saying that, you know, this book comes down on a side that is quite apart from the inquiry's determination about those four officers, I'm not suggesting that there was no point in the inquiry. There wasn't good that came out of the inquiry. Of course there was. That being the case, however, there were also some consequences of the inquiry and Thomas Braidwood's condemnation of these four people that had very serious consequences for everybody. Not the least of which was someone like Sergeant Pierre Lamette, who was the RCMP public spokesperson, who in 2013 killed himself because of the way he was portrayed in the media as being the spin doctor, the mouthpiece, the liar for the Mounties about how all of this went down.
You write in the book that you mentioned Braidwood, and I just want to touch on him for just a second. You describe him, I think, as a news junkie, as someone who watches TV news a lot. And there's a line in the book that I was curious about, and I'll ask you about how it came about. It says that watching everything that he did, even before he got the call to head up an inquiry, he already had some notion in his mind as to what happened and who was to blame.
I interviewed Thomas Braidwood long after all of this was said and done, and sat with him and asked him to sort of take me through the process of how he learned about this incident, how he remembered seeing the video, what he thought at the time, how he became the inquiry commissioner, and so on and so forth. So what you read in the book is what he told me, which was he saw the video the same way most of the rest of us did, which was on the news. He had a visceral reaction to that video, the same way I think most of us did, which was, this is horrible. He also told me, as you read in the book, which I attribute to him, is that he formed an opinion that the only way the Mounties could redeem themselves by appearing at his inquiry would be to essentially recant everything they told investigators about what had happened. So he did form several opinions prior to sitting in judgment of the evidence. That being the case, he also assured me that as someone who is an experienced jurist, he was able to put all of that aside and still weigh the evidence as it would unfold for him as the head of the inquiry. But I thought it was important to include that in the book to show very clearly that just because somebody is a judge, just because somebody wears a robe, who has sat for however many years on the bench and judged in so many cases, they are still human. They still have human instincts, flaws, biases. We like to think that people who rise to the level of being a judge in the Supreme Court, or the Supreme Court of Canada for that matter, are somehow able to divorce themselves of personal opinions. I think I think some of us expect that journalists do the same thing, you know, that somehow, you know, the best journalists are people who are able to just kind of not form an opinion about anything and just simply, you know, give me the facts.
Yeah.
Well, I hate to break it to you, but there isn't a journalist alive that I know who doesn't have an opinion about a story they're doing. The safeguard, I think, for journalists is that we try to wait until we have asked all the questions. And when you don't do that kind of work, it shows in the end product. The story ends up having all kinds of holes. What about this? What about that? Why didn't you ask this question? What about this answer? And so that's what I tried to do in Blamed and Broken, is I kept asking questions until every question I had and could think of and other people could think of had been asked. And at the end of it, I present a whole series of facts that I think when, you know, a reasonable person reads it and steps back from it, they will conclude at least that they didn't know everything, and that some of what they thought, if not all of it, is less than complete.
I'll ask you about your own story in just a sec, but back to public inquiries for a sec. We're you know, hearing a lot of people calling for them, whether it's about money laundering or real estate, ICBC, the stuff that's happened at the legislature. People are still talking about a BC Rail inquiry, even though I think that's past due now. When people say things like that, I mean, in having lived through this inquiry, there are things that we ought to heed before we call on one. Or
yeah,
first of all, it's a lot of money too, right?
Yeah, it's. I mean, you know, yes, it's a lot of money. I think, you know, public inquiries or royal commissions are this sort of uniquely, you know, Commonwealth idea. The United States doesn't have anything quite like that, and they could probably actually benefit from having something like a royal commission of inquiry process. I've been involved as a journalist in a number of public inquiries. When I was at the Parliamentary Bureau in Ottawa, I led coverage on the Mayor Arar Commission of Inquiry into his extraordinary rendition and torture in Syria. I led the daily reporting on the sponsorship inquiry, the Gomery inquiry, it was called, you know, into all of that. And going back into my early days as a journalist, I did an investigation into an allegation that a plan was hatched in the office of the Premier of Manitoba, Gary Filmon, to try to basically subvert a provincial election by creating dummy political parties, which would then siphon off votes from the NDP. And as a result of the work I did back in the 90s on that, Filmon was actually forced to call a public inquiry. And at the end of the day, the retired judge who led that public inquiry said that in all his years on the bench, he had never encountered so many liars. It did not end well for Gary Filmon and the Conservatives in Manitoba. They lost the next election, and, you know, the Conservatives were out of power for, you know, more than a decade. So public inquiries serve a really good purpose. We should hold them. Sometimes it's the only way you can get at information. I guess what I've learned in sort of being involved heavily in watching the Braidwood inquiry is that sometimes they don't give you the whole story. And at the end of the day, it is the inquiry commissioner who decides, who comes down and says, here's what the facts say. If you read Braidwood's inquiry report, there are a number of points at which he says, I have to decide whether this, that, or the other. One of the things that Braidwood had to decide is, you know, did the taser actually cause Jurkansky's death? Or was it something else? Was it the physical struggle? Was it something that was going on before the police even arrived? I mean, so he had to sort of absorb all the evidence and come down on a conclusion. But that's his conclusion, right? There was evidence to the contrary. And, you know, I think most of us, again, reasonably can sort of imagine that the taser had certainly had something to do with it. Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine that it couldn't. But then when you get into areas of did the police lie about what they did or what they saw, that is really a matter of opinion. And as we saw when this case was then punted up to the criminal court, two judges determined that the officers did not lie. Two judges determined that the officers did. So you have this bizarre, absurd legal result that these four officers who were allegedly conspiring to cover up what they did and how they did it were a conspiracy, and yet two of the officers were found not to have participated in a conspiracy of four, but two of the officers were found to have conspired with the other two. And it's just this really sort of absurd, untenable result that doesn't make any sense, really, outside of a criminal court. But at the end of the day, you've got two of these RCMP officers who were acquitted of perjury, and acquitted handily. When the first officer was acquitted, the special prosecutor appealed it, was just booted out of the appeal court with their case. That was shut down. The second officer to be acquitted, they didn't even bother to try to appeal. However, those two officers who were acquitted are named in the other two officers' decisions of conviction as being part of the conspiracy. So even more absurd and, quite frankly, offensive as this two-and-two verdict, you've got a situation where even though they were acquitted, these two officers, they're still labeled as essentially guilty in another decision. And like that, how is that justice?
How do you move on from
that? Well, how do you ever remove all doubt, right? Isn't that what a court is supposed to do? In this case, it failed miserably to remove the doubt. You know, you can believe whatever you want. Don't read the book. I don't care. Well, I do care. I want everybody to read the book. But you can believe what you want about the guilt of those two officers who were found guilty of perjury. But how is it rational or reasonable that the other two are not? And even at the Supreme Court of Canada, when I sat in that trial, the best the one Supreme Court justice could offer to try to sort of, round the corners of this square was to say, well, maybe the judges who acquitted made the mistake. Maybe that's where the absurdity lies. And that's, you know, if they were only convicted. So now you have even a Supreme Court of Canada justice suggesting on the record that two people who were acquitted, maybe they were guilty. Like, if that's not a continuation of a narrative against the facts, I mean, I don't know what is. I really don't.
You mentioned at the end of the book that your own diagnosis with PTSD. You were the subject of a terrific documentary by Helen Slinger and Maureen Palmer that aired on the CBC. Was it a year or so ago? 2 years ago now?
Just coming up on 2 years
ago. I mean, is talking about PTSD, is it helpful at all for you?
You know, I've done it a lot. I mean, that's been sort of part of my therapy. The book, in fact, was part of my therapy because I was at a point when I was I was having some very severe symptoms of PTSD. And, you know, I've been a journalist for more than half my life, which is hard to believe sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I got taken away from that. I couldn't do it. And that in and of itself was devastating. And so my doctors, who I actually thank in the book, one of the things they said was, well, you know, you should try writing. I said, well, I don't want to write about this. I don't want to write about, well, just write about anything. Mm-hmm. Write about anything that you care about. And that's sort of where this little candle flame of an idea developed that, you know, this had always bothered me. It was a story that was kind of unfinished for me, you know, back when I sort of developed PTSD symptoms. This was still sort of going on. It was still going through the courts, and it had become this monster of, you know, this, you know, dense fact laden kind of, you know, so many different characters. And it seemed daunting at the time, but at the same time I thought, well, maybe there's something to it. So I started to write. And so the writing was therapy. I have gone on to speak at the odd gathering of people interested in mental health. You know, I don't know what it is I have to offer, but I've certainly been through it. To some extent, I'm still sort of going through it. But I'm fortunate that I had some, you know, against all odds, I had some really excellent treatment. It's not really a part of the book, but one of the things I've learned over the last few years is that mental health is really, you know, often treated like, in the sort of medical profession, it's often treated like a hangnail. You know, it's not considered a priority. I mean, when I first developed symptoms of PTSD, I was told by the insurance company, no less, that had every motivation to try to get me well again and get me back to work. I was told, yeah, you need psychiatric help. The problem is the waiting list to see a psychiatrist is over a year. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that shouldn't happen. I'm talking about it does help, has helped in the past. I mean, there are certain things that I don't talk about, but I'm a lot better than I was a few years ago. And you know what? Writing the book helped. You know, when I first started out writing Blamed and Broken, I didn't really think about, will it be published? You know, who's going to read it, whatever. I did it because I had to do it. I had to put this out. I had to get it out of me. I had to connect all of these dots that were connected in my head, but didn't make sense to anybody else. And I thought, I got to do something. I got to lay this out in a way that makes sense to somebody else. And if I can do that, then I'm doing my job as a journalist. I'm relaying something, not just as a series of facts, but I'm connecting them for people. And, you know, if somebody reads it, if one person reads it and says, aha, now I understand, then you know, that's good enough for me. Fortunately, more than one person has read this book, and virtually everybody who's read it has thought it was overdue and necessary, and has liked it, which has been rewarding. But the reward for me was actually just basically getting it all out and putting it down. And I got to say, holding it to a standard that I've applied to everything I've done my entire life as a journalist, which is to be sure in my heart and in my mind about what I'm telling people. It's what I believe. And it's not just what I believe as an opinion. I've done the work, and I've talked to people, and I've looked up the facts. And, you know, this book is the product of that.
So it is a jigsaw puzzle that is finished now. Is the story finished for you?
You know, it is. This particular story is finished. The one of the very last things that I added at the last minute before they had to basically close off the manuscript and have it printed occurred in September or October. It was just a couple of points I needed to make. That being said, these people's lives are still going on. The four Mounties, who are two of them ex-Mounties, mm-hmm. Who are at the center of this book, they're all suing the RCMP. I have no idea where that's going to go. Their lives go on. Pierre Lemaitre, who killed himself, his widow settled with the RCMP, but she has to go on with her life, understanding that all of these things happened. And she read it, by the way. She was one of the very first people that I wanted mm-hmm. to see, wanted to show the manuscript to, Sheila Lemaitre. And I don't think I'm giving anything away, but she read it in the space of 12 hours. And I was concerned because, as you know, there's a chapter in here. And again, I could not have written this book without having focused at least an entire chapter on Pierre.
Mm-hmm.
And I was worried what she would think because there's a lot of personal detail in here. And as with a lot of people, not everything is flattering about people that I write about. There's a lot of unflattering material. She read it and she said, "Thank you for writing this. You've treated everybody with empathy, and that's what's been missing from this for 10 years. And that, to me, was the reward for having put all the years and effort into this book, was to have somebody who had a very personal connection tell me that they were glad I did it.
What's next for you? Are you going to write again?
I don't know. I got to tell you, I never set out to write a book, and one of the reasons why I didn't want to write a book was because I knew it was a lot of work. Apocryphally, it was just, you know, everybody talks about how difficult it is to write, and the editing process, and it really is. You know, there were times when I was in the middle of dealing with PTSD, and so there were days that I couldn't even type a character. There were days that I'd do a paragraph or, you know, a page or whatever.
Yeah.
It was painful. And, you know, people, I think, also talk about, you know, for writers, the tyranny of the blank page. It's a writer is somebody who sits at a keyboard and bleeds, or things, you know, tears mm-hmm. come out. So I don't know. I think I learned a lot writing the book, just from how to write. I mean, I've written for decades, but writing in literary form is quite different. I think if I found the right subject, I would do it. I don't think I will ever find a subject like this for the rest of my life and the rest of my career as a journalist. I mean, this, in a sense, was over 10 years worth of paying attention to something. I can count on one hand the number of stories that I'm proud and that I would include in this realm. And I don't know that I would want to actually sit through something like this for another 10 years because, you know, as rewarding as it is to write the book, you know, in these pages is a lot of grief. A lot of people were hurt, were damaged. You know, I sat with a lot of people who cried, who today still carry around psychological scars, not the least of which is Robert Tuchansky's mother, Zofia Tisovsky.
Mm-hmm.
She lost her only son. And no amount of criminal trials or inquiries or lawsuit settlements with the government is going to bring him back. And so, you know, there's a lot of hurt and pain in these pages that I wouldn't want to go through again. That being said, this was my way of, I guess, dealing with it. And I hope at the end of the day it's enough for people because I don't know that I could do it again.
You mentioned earlier that you're on leave from the CBC.
Yeah.
Will we see you on television anytime soon?
Who knows? I don't know. Journalism is my life. As I think I said, it's like something I've spent more than half my life doing. I think I will always want to. I mean, that's what I know. That's what I love. You know, it's a combination of the love of telling stories, but also shedding light on things, being able to give people information that helps them in some way. And and almost entirely I've spent that working for the National Public Broadcaster, which I've always considered to be honorable and valuable work. I would certainly like to continue doing that kind of journalism because it's what I see is valuable. I don't have any other skills.
Well, having gone through what you've gone through, and we've talked about it already in the course of our chat, when young people come up to you and say that they would like to go into your business,
yep.
What do you tell them?
Well, I've spoken to some journalism students who obviously face a different landscape in terms of how you're a journalist. But in some ways, it's no different than it ever was. Number one, I would say you got to do it because you love it. You're not going to get rich. This is not a profession to choose if you want to make a lot of money. At least it's not been my case. There are some, you know, pretty faces and people who sort of become, you know, the public icons of broadcast or whatever that might do fairly well for themselves. But again, that's not really journalism. That's more entertainment. I would say, and what I do say is if you love what you do and you're motivated for the right reasons, you're going to be telling stories in one form or another that are important to people. And there's a reason why people are going to want to follow you or read what you say or hear what you have to say. And if you've got that, then use it. It's in some ways it's a gift. You have an obligation to do that. I don't know how many more years we have in this world for when books are things that people care about. I hope it's a long time, because I still think book journalism is the kind of journalism that we need more of. Mm. That being said, there's nothing wrong with a 30-second story. But if it's a 30-second story, if that's all you're interested in writing as a journalist, you're not going to have a very fulfilling career. I certainly wouldn't. I mean, that's assembly line. That's, you know, you're making something that is fleeting and, you know, is maybe consumable for a moment, but it's not very nutritious. You can't survive on that kind of journalism. The other thing I say is, you know, don't think that the only thing there is about journalism is the big scoop or the gotcha or the, you know, the game-changing story and all the rest of it. Because fundamentally, again, what I think journalism is telling stories. And not every story is one in which you've caught somebody doing something. That should never be the motivation for approaching a story. It should be a natural curiosity to understand how something works or why something is the way it is, and finding your way into that story by finding the people. I mean, one of the things that I say over and over and over again is that despite all of the technology we have, all the kind of access now to emails and leaks and documents and all the rest of it, at the end of the day, the most important asset to you as a journalist are human sources. And they always will be. Mm-hmm. And you have to be able to develop relationships with people in order to tell their stories. And I could not have written this book if I did not have human sources, if people weren't going to tell me things, if people weren't going to be honest with me, if people weren't going to give me the time. I could not have written this based on reading a bunch of documents. The documents were important to verify what some people were saying and doing, but without people and without my interest and ability to sort of spend time talking to people, I couldn't have done it. And to me, that's what journalism is. And, you know, technology is just a means to sort of maybe disseminate your story. But at the end of the day, you still got to talk to people.
And that's what we see in this book. It's a very fine achievement. Congratulations, Kurt, on its publication. Continued good luck with it and everything else. I appreciate you coming in to do this. I'm a great admirer of your work over the years, and so for me, this has been fun to get to meet you and talk to you about this tremendous book.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity, Joseph. It's been a pleasure.
The website for more is at kurtpetrovich.ca, at Retro Canada is the Twitter handle. The book is called Blamed and Broken, The Mounties and the Death of Robert Jakansky. It's published by Dundurn. Its author, Kurt Petrovich, joined me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Ponta.